Welcome to the orange edition of the Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture. This is the sixth in our annual series of lectures. We have already established a distinguished history of speakers, which we will continue today. But before I introduce our speaker today, let me mention some of our previous speakers. We have had as speakers Professor Polishin from Australia. We have had Professor Grabovich from Harvard. We have had Dr. Chernetsky, Vinitsky, and Koznarski. And today we will have an equally distinguished speaker. This lecture series honors the memory of Danilo Husar-Struk, who I am very proud to say was my colleague, who was a professor of Ukrainian language and literature in the Slavic department at this university, and who was very well known in the scholarly community for a number of different endeavors. Most prominently, of course, he was known for his editorial work on the five-volume Encyclopedia of Ukraine, a stellar accomplishment in the Ukrainian scholarship in the diaspora, and one that surely would not have been possible. Those of us who saw it happen know full well that it would not have happened at all had it not been for Danilo, for his dedication, and for his energy. Another aspect of Danilo's activity, and perhaps the one to which he gave the greatest passion in his life, passion in the academic sense, I will refrain from all other uses of that word, particularly in view of what the subject of today's talk is. The area in which Danilo showed the greatest passion was in his love for literature, particularly his love for poetry. And so today's talk on poetry, on Ukrainian poetry in the diaspora, is most particularly appropriate. Danilo's energy and passion for literature were exemplified in any number of ways, most particularly in his work as a teacher. He was devoted to promoting Ukrainian literature here in Canada and generally throughout our world. Presumably, Ukrainian poetry promotes itself in Ukraine without our help. This year would have been Danilo's retirement year. And it gives me great pride to say that in Danilo's tradition and in his footsteps, we have continued to develop Ukrainian literary studies here at the University of Toronto, and not only with this annual lecture. We have much to be proud of, and I think Danilo has much to be proud of in the legacy he has left for Ukrainian literary studies here at the University of Toronto. This year, for example, we are very proud to be honoring two doctorants in our department who, and while it has not yet happened, both of them have yet to defend their dissertation, I assure you they will successfully defend their dissertation, and within 2 months, we will have two more PhDs, not formally granted, since they will both need to wait to the November conferral to actually hold the diploma. In addition to that, we have two more PhD students in our program working towards eventual completion. We are proud to have other activities as well. We have had visitors from Ukraine giving talks as part of the program of the Petro Yasek program in Ukrainian studies here at the university. We have also promoted translations. I invite you, by the way, to attend the launch, the Toronto launch of our journal entitled Ukrainian Literature, a journal devoted to English translations of Ukrainian literary works. The launch will take place on June 2nd at the Kumpf Art Gallery at 7:30 p.m. That's a Thursday, June 2nd. I invite you to attend. And so Danilo has much to look down on in terms of the legacy he has left and the tradition that we uphold here in Toronto. Today's speaker is herself a prominent example of both Danilo's successes and the legacy he has left. Maria Radakovich is also a PhD from our program and a student who began her graduate work under Danilo's tutelage. And indeed, the topic on which she will speak tonight, the New York Group of Poets, was the topic of her dissertation, and it was a topic that she selected with Danilo, that he approved, and one, I must say, he was very much excited about. The New York School of Poets is a subject Danilo knew a great deal about, more than I do, to be honest. And so we have a living testimony to his legacy. In addition to the PhD she holds from our university, Maria Radakovich also holds a master's degree in library science. She has an MA from our university as well. And she is an example of the successes our students can earn in the scholarly world in North America. Since her graduation from our department, Maria has kept herself very busy, perhaps busier than she would want to be. She has earned quite a number of fellowships and academic awards. She has, in the year following her conferral, she won the Sklar Fellowships, one of the Sklar Fellowships at Harvard University. In the year subsequent to that, she was a fellow at the Kennan Institute in Washington. And in the year subsequent to that, which is the year we are in now, she is a Neporan Fellowship holder at Columbia University. She has taught at a number of schools. She has taught at Rutgers. She has taught, well, at Columbia, she's teaching there now as part of her Neporan. She, of course, taught in our department. She has taught in the Harvard Summer School. Maria is an accomplished scholar. She has published a number of scholarly essays, mostly on the New York School of Poets, a school of poets of which she is also a member, because in addition to her scholarly activities, Maria is also a poet of considerable skill. She is also a compiler of anthologies. So in addition to her own four collections of poetry, she has recently published the volume you see here on the table, an anthology of the poetry of the New York School of Poets. I think I'm taking too much of your time. Let me hasten to conclude by introducing Dr. Maria Radakovich, who will speak to us on the subject, Eros and Exile, Poetic Visions of the New York Group.
Thank you so much for such a generous introduction. I feel privileged and very grateful to have this opportunity to present the Danilo Strug Memorial Lecture. It is indeed a great honor for me to be able to speak before such a distinguished audience, especially Professor Strug's family and friends. And I'm truly moved to see so many of you tonight. Professor Strug was my thesis supervisor, as Professor Tarasky already mentioned, at the time of his untimely passing. In fact, I was his last doctoral candidate. And I will always cherish and remember his wise counsel and warm humor. My acquaintance with Professor Strug goes back to the early 1980s. He was the first professor that I encountered shortly after arrival in Canada. And I still have a vivid memory from one of his literature courses, classes that I attended as an audit in the spring of 1982. But my close association with him began a decade ago when I decided to resume my PhD studies at the University of Toronto, majoring in Ukrainian literature. It was truly a pleasure to be able to work with him for 3 years. He had this wonderful way of building confidence and at the same time knowing when and how to provide the right dose of criticism. I chose my lecture tonight on the NEO group, as it was already mentioned, because it was the subject that Professor Strug himself was very much interested in. And he wrote a number of insightful essays on some of the members of the NEO group and on the group as a whole. And, for example, in Mandiyevska, Bogdan Polchuk, Bogdan Lukchak, to mention just a few. And he mentioned once to me that he would be really interested in supervising the a dissertation on the New York group. So this is how I got involved in that as well, like from a scholarly perspective, so to say. So tonight, my lecture is my tribute to Professor Strug's impressive legacy in literary studies. The connection between Eros and exile when it comes to creativity is not as startling as it might initially seem. The most quoted classic example is Elvis, whose erotic work, Out of Love, which praised adultery, among other things, was not well received by the Roman Emperor Augustus, and this resulted in the poet's exile in 8 AD to Tomis, a frontier town on the west coast of Black Sea, until his death a decade later. Exile as punishment conveys its most narrow sense. It was true for Dante, as it was more recently for Joseph Brodsky. Taken metaphorically, exile designates every kind of estrangement and displacement from the geographical and linguistic to the spiritual. Some scholars like to further qualify exile as voluntary or involuntary, extroverted or introverted, internal / spiritual or political. Bettina Knapp, for example, speaks of two kinds of exile. Exoteric, which stands for, quote, permanent physical departure from the land and banishment to areas outside of the boundaries of the country. And esoteric, which suggests, quote, a withdrawal on the part of individuals from the empirical realm and a desire or need to live predominantly in their inner world, end of quote. However, regardless of how we choose to define exile, broadly or narrowly, the question I want to consider here is whether the link between Eros and exile is more than circumstantial or coincidental, as it was in the Ovid's case, and how it can be applied to the poetic output put forth by the new group of Ukrainian emigrant poets. Eros, traditionally the god of love, points well beyond a new personification. It is a force of irresistible attraction, which, if not controlled, can lead to destruction. According to Anne Carlson, quote, the Greek word eros denotes want, lack, desire for that which is missing. Illness, in other words, is essentially lack and desire to possess what is perceived as valuable, yet absent. Or, as in Plato, illness is the soul striving for the good and the beautiful. Exile, not surprisingly, implies lack as well. It uncovers the nostalgia for a lost home and entails an irresistible desire to recover that precious and lost space. Whether or not this space or home lost necessarily refers to the place of origin is an entirely different question, and I will return to this later. Illness and exile, therefore, represent strife and are dynamic, yet provisional. Both involve a movement, a shift, either physical or psychological, and both deal with an issue of boundaries, be it political or emotional. Carson puts it beautifully, quote, in the interval between reach and grasp, between glance and counter-glance, between I love you and I love you too, the absent presence of desire comes alive. And it is only suddenly, at the moment when I could dissolve that boundary, I realize I never can, end of quote. What should become clear by now is that illness and exile do not serve here as technical terms, rather they constitute images or signposts for my exploration of the near group's poetic vision. The original group of seven, which will be my focus in this lecture, namely Bogdan Bulchuk, Yuri Tarnavsky, Bogdan Lukchak, and Mandieska, Zhenya Vasilkivska, Patricia Kulina, and Vera Volk, all of whom were creatively most active in the 1950s and 1960s, lends itself exceptionally well to the analysis from the erotic and exilic angles. Illness and exile, to various degrees, are thematized in their poems, but more importantly, I argue, illness and exile act as powerful drives behind the poet's creative endeavors. That is, I would like to make a distinction between the thematic and the ontological. In other words, illness and exile figure both as a theme and as a particular state of being, a condition, which all the poets mention above consciously or subconsciously found themselves flung into. In many ways, one could perhaps question the appropriateness of imposing the exilic condition upon the members of the new group. After all, they settle in their adopted homelands as children or young adults, establish themselves professionally, and the memories of the native land were by and large imagined and constructed rather than based on actual recollection. Yet, as I had argued in my earlier essay on the New York group's poetics of exile, despite this seeming adjustment, they did not escape the grips of exilic sensibility. The post-war physical displacement the poets experienced was involuntary, thus punitive. Whether they found themselves in the West on their own or together with their parents, going back to Ukraine under the Soviet regime would entail, at best, a lack of freedom, at worst, imprisonment and persecution. Moreover, the linguistic choice they made, that is, selecting Ukrainian language as a medium for artistic expression, forced them early on to deal with issues of identity, otherness, and cultural loyalties. Contrary to the prevailing paradigm of an exile in which the other, the foreign land, is unloved and only reminds the subject of unbearable loss and separation, the new group embraced its exilic condition as something positive and enriching. Yet the linguistic factor, as well as the tyranny of difference or existential in-betweenness, brought about by displacement, i.e. dealing with more than one culture, more than one language, more than one home, or with what Edward Said calls a contrapuntal awareness, has situated the poet in the unenviable space of non-belonging. Thomas Pabel once remarked that exile as punishment is reserved for those who count. The political expulsion of such persona stirs attention and compels the other to learn more about them. And if these figures happen to be artists or writers, there's a thirst on the part of an educated foreigner to acquaint himself, herself, with their creative output. Thus, the linguistic barrier is invariably overcome with the help of influential individuals eager to assist those who are worthy of such support and suffer injustice at the hands of native political regimes. For writers, it means securing translations for their works and engaging good publishers. The name of Andrei Sinyavsky and Joseph Brodsky immediately come to mind as examples from the 20th century. For these individuals, a widespread recognition to some degree helped to alleviate that which was lost. The poets of the New York group represent a different paradigm, since the exilic moment does not confirm them as a point of their artistic maturity, but haunts them nonetheless as an afterthought, a trace or shadow to be endured. The strategies employed to mitigate alienation and isolation are necessarily of a different kind. First and foremost, instead of treading an individual path, they choose support and comfort that comes with the group activity. The feeling of solidarity and mutual understanding among the poets moves forward many joint projects, like, for example, the publishing of the annual Novi Poezji, New Poetry, from 1959 to 1971, and thereby contributed considerably to the initial cohesiveness of the group's creative platform. In this creative realm, I view Ehlers in exile as thematic and ontological signposts, opening up possibilities for interpreting the new group's poetic output. I argue that these entities serve as strategies or coping mechanisms for internalizing the encroaching elsewhere. Ehlers, laden with desire, offers a promise of a new beginning. Exile, on the other hand, opens the door to a new freedom and possibly a new home. The idea of home in the poetry of the Neo group acquires various shapes and incarnations. It might refer to the poet's personal sphere, or it might entail his, her relationship to the lost homeland. In either case, the general tendency is to claim universality and to dispense with nostalgic sentiment. Madame Kuchuk, for example, in the first collection, Charles Borlo, The Time of Pain, published in 1957, revealed a considerable dose of skepticism as to the possibility of speaking about home in other than contingent terms. Quote, yes, home stood somewhere, and perhaps did not. The goal was somewhere, and perhaps was not. I went somewhere and knew my path leads nowhere. I went and knew my steps are life. The apparent pessimism of this poem very much stems from the poet's own personal experience, captured by the Nazis and transported to Germany for hard labor in 1944. He witnessed the human loss and destruction of cities of unspeakable proportion. No wonder that in the aftermath of the World War II horrors, he distrusts the idea of stable home. Bertuk often reminiscences about his childhood and peasant upbringing, but underscores the universal pain of being thrown into existence rather than the loss of specificity. Yet he is not a cosmopolitan poet. Implicit in his poetry is a longing for his native land, but it comes across more as a rational celebration of its rich tradition. For example, the poems of Stone Women and the Blind Bandura Players, then as homesickness. Also absent is a typically exilic tendency to turn the mother country into a lover. The paradigm of a homeland reimagined as an erotic object of desire does not apply to the poetry of the Neo group. In fact, in the case of Bolchuk and Yuri Tarnatsky, we are dealing with an interesting reversal. It is the elsewhere, the foreign land, that becomes a lover. In Vichy La Mexico, Poems for Mexico, published in 1964, Bolchuk personifies Mexico, makes it a woman, and then falls in love with her. Tarnatsky, on the other hand, displays his passion for things Spanish. In his Vespasiani, Without Spain, published in 1969, the vision of Spain is internalized to the point that it dissolves into various parts of the lyrical hero's body. The hotel room projects obsessive reminiscences about a farewell with a lover that is Spain. She is beautiful, desirable, and very much missed. One can only speculate what is the provenance of this parallel approach. Personally, I think it has to do something with similarities in the poet's biography. Both lost their mothers at an early age, and it happened back home in Ukraine. Both left their native land in their teens. Therefore, the lost homeland would be reimagined more as a mother figure than a lover. By the same token, the feelings they have reserved for their country cannot be erotic but filial. Interestingly, the other, i.e. the adopted homeland, remains unmarked. It is occasionally Timaray, but its relationship to the lyrical hero is neither that of a lover nor son. Yuri Samaski, despite his considerable efforts to project an image of a cosmopolitan, in the end does not avoid the traps of exilic reality. As I pointed out in my earlier essay, his pronounced cosmopolitanism is but a consciously chosen mask behind which we see the face of an exiled person who deeply cares about the fate of his native land. But his political concerns and passionate cry about the colonial status of Ukraine surfaced relatively late, mainly in the post-Chernobyl period of the second half of the 1980s, when the cycle Dorothy Wilsch's out poem and long poem Urana, published on the eve of independence in 1991. True, we witnessed the first signs of his engagé approach to poetry as early as in the 1970s, but these were by and large isolated cases. For example, the poem Russia, he addresses the colonizer in no flattering words. A country, you suffer from a maternity complex and rub other nations with the barbed wire of your love. Why is that not one among your sons comes forward and says, please, leave them alone, the mother? Damaski's pronounced response to the political situation in Ukraine contrasts with his poem Zapovit, Testament, written about the same time, that is early 1970s, and a desire expressed there to have his ashes spread over the sea in Santa Fe, the Spanish city where he lived on and off in the mid-1960s. The contradictory nature of these responses points to the pervasive presence of exotic sensibility. Everything bears marks of being contingent, provisional, and polyphonic. His first two collections, however, namely Життя в місті, Life in the City, published 1956, and Поповоду в Покіпці, Afternoons in Покіпці, published in 1960, seem unmarked by the exile factor in the thematic sense. The poetic tales presented there are fully grounded in the existential realities of everyday living, the Paris here now, so to say, though without references to specific events and locales. The poem's foreground motives of love, death, and the city are in the center of it all. We have a lyrical hero who is skeptical, dissatisfied, and struggling to overcome apparent absurdity of life. Samaski's next two collections, Spomeny, Memory, and Idealizowana Biografia, Idealized Biography, both published in 1964, constitute a turning point of sorts. Memory represents an attempt on the poet's part to reclaim the past and to build out of fragmented childhood memories the image of a lost home. This painful recollection, conveyed as a series of surreal narratives, conflates the vision of the homeland waged by war with that of a dying mother. The death of the poet's mother becomes a metaphor for his lost homeland and eventual displacement in time and space. Idealized biography comes as an antipode to such a loss, not only thematically, but formally as well. Dense, hermetic prose poems of memories come as a stark contrast to lyrical miniatures found in biography. It is a collection of 50 love poems in which the amorous and erotic are fused into an indissoluble whole. Turning to love, however, does not compensate the feeling of intense alienation. The initial optimism of Damaski's lyrical hero is progressively superseded by the existential angst and profound doubt. appearance as it emerges in idealized biography is perceived as a marked absence. Any relationship, it seems, is doomed at the outset, because in the face of death, each person stands alone. Wojciech's eras, on the other hand, comes across as more positive and radiant. The footprints of existentialists are still recognizable, like in Tarnowski's oeuvre, but lovemaking in Wojciech's poetry acquires celebratory qualities. In fact, love alone is capable of alleviating loneliness and the anguish of death. It comes as a compensatory force, which also helps to overcome the feeling of not belonging, stemming from the exotic position. Moreover, Wojciech's images of women, always fertile, full of life and life-giving, represent the regenerative force, seemingly the only force fitted to counterbalance the despair of a man facing the burden of his own perplexing existence and imminent death. For example, the poem Vecher, The Evening, ends with, quote, men drift towards women whose hips grow into clay huts and their hearts grow light. Mark Rodman, Wojciech's translator, put it succinctly, quote, his search for the girl, woman, could stand as a metaphor for all of his work. No answers are ever forthcoming. But Wojciech, refusing consolation, keeps the dialogue alive. End of quote. In the end, simply the ability to speak out, to have a voice, regardless of how limiting the circumstances are, creates a powerful therapeutic catharsis capable of undermining the impact of exilic marginality. If for Wojciech and Tarnowski the dynamic between eros and exile reveals itself most conspicuously in the realm of space, both territorial and psychological, for Emma Andrievska and Patricia Kulina, it is rooted in the realm of language. Andrievska and Kulina stand, of course, on opposite ends of the language spectrum. The former is considered a master of the Ukrainian language, a credit often denied to other members of the new group. The latter is a newcomer, in fact, a foreigner who fell in love with things Ukrainian and began writing poetry in a foreign language. Exile as such is not thematized in their poetry, but both poets display mental and emotional attitudes that bear the traces of the exilic condition. Kulina's case is a case of linguistic self-exile. Being American, she consciously chose the status of the other in her own country. She exiled herself into the realm of a foreign language, de facto closing poetic channels of communication with her native audience. Andrievska's approach is less straightforward, but parallels Kulina's in the importance of linguistic choices. Andrievska chose Ukrainian as her only medium of poetic expression, and that might not seem so straightforward if we know about her background a little bit. She was born in Donetsk and in the Russian-speaking family. And in one of her interviews, she mentioned that there was quite a bit of pressure put on her to attend the Russian school, but she insisted on attending the Ukrainian school. So that was a kind of choice on her part as well. The richness of Andrievska's lexicon and the abundance of her imagination make her poetry hermetic, not easily translatable, and somewhat inaccessible even to Ukrainian readers. In other words, her poetic universe is so different and novel that acts as if it were, metaphorically speaking, a foreign land. This is, of course, an outside perspective, but it also underscores one important aspect about Andrievska's oeuvre, namely the distance she insists on keeping between her own self and her creation. But this relationship lacks the attributes of alterity, that is, otherness, which is very much Kulina's case. There seems to be another connection between these two poets, and it has to do with homosexuality. Andrievska thematized it in her cycle Dionysi, Dionysia. Kulina chose it as a way of life. Her departure from Ukrainian literature and transformation back to patricial Warren triggered by her divorce with Yuri Tarnowski coincides with her acceptance of gay identity. Kirina's Eros is experiential, that is inextricably linked to her personal choices with regard to sexuality. In her poetry, however, Eros is by and large a marked absence. Andrieska's private persona, on the other hand, is never exposed. It appears coincidental that her poetic cycle settles for Eros with a homosexual orientation. But there's a reason for that. Andrieska's erotica foregrounds the ancient Greek tradition, wherein homosexuality, including pederasty, was not only tolerated, but to some extent encouraged. In the context of the rituals devoted to the Dionysian festivals in honor of the Hellenic god of fertility and wine, the following line should not really shock. Quote, "He, with the clusters of grapes in his voice, let him abandon his flute and come toward me. Today I shall love him, I, whose name they fear to speak. Let him take off the clothing that defiles his body and sit blushing like a girl, with his hands covering his divine flowers. Today I shall love him, I, whose name they are ashamed to pronounce." So these lines should not shock, but they did. The Ukrainian emigrating year of the early 1960s was not quite prepared to receive, well, poetic essays of homosexuality. As I already alluded, Patricia Kalina's interest in the erotic is rather slight, especially when viewed from the entirety of her poetic evolution. Curiously, her first two collections are notably free of any erotic or even romantic motifs. Only in the third collection, Rozhavy Mista, Pink Cities, published in 1969, does the poet reveal a more lyrical side of her poetic persona. This collection includes the cycle of sonnets entitled Alumini y Roja, Aluminium and Rose, in which the themes of love, freedom, temporality, fate, and death constitute indispensable links in the chain of life. Death is not perceived as an inevitable evil, but as a measure against which things are weighed. The temporality of life is serenely accepted, not argued with. Love presented in Aluminium in Rose lacks carnal dimension, but the erotic element is present, though in an insinuated rather than explicit manner, in Kulina's other cycle entitled Minimali Poesi, Minimal Poem. Quote, "Your lovemaking is a laser ray so bright it shines through my substance, opaque like steel. It is from me they will see you, the green ray so invisible that inside me like a water muddy from milk, they will see your mysterious transformation, the ray so frightening that it will reflect your mortal spectrum from me, the necessary mirror. But from the light's plethora, I myself become a ray, and you, my transparent steel." The image of a ray shining through, penetrating, undoubtedly carries valid connotations. The beauty of this poem, however, lies in the capturing of the essence of an erotic act, the moment in which the roles of agent and patient become meaningless. The perpetrator is simultaneously the one being perpetrated, I, myself, become a ray, and you, my transparent steel. The confluence of subject and object in the act of lovemaking underscores the instability of the socially constructed gender role. The other becomes an indispensable mirror for an agent, and conversely, because of this indispensability, the other itself becomes an agent. The lyrical heroine in the mass poem herself becomes a ray, here a symbolic of phallic power. Because without her presence, real or imaginary, the whole act of lovemaking loses its purpose. When one falls in love, or leaves the homeland, one abandons the forms of ordinary life and enters into an extraordinary mode of existence. The affinities between exiles and lovers are particularly manifested in the deep-seated longing to merge with an object of desire. Love can be directed towards another human being, towards a lost homeland, towards the language and for creative individuals, toward the muse as well. Julia Kristeva once remarked, quote, writing is impossible without some kind of exile, end of quote. And there's some truth in the fact that the exilic position can trigger a creative response for an individual's and artistic disposition. I can bring an example from my own personal experience. When I arrived in Canada in 1982, turning to poetry was for me like finding a new home, a new family, which in real life was far away and absent from my here and now. Poetry as refuge and the muse figures quite strongly in the oeuvre of Bogdan Lubchak. In his collection, Dievčina bez krajine, For a Girl Without a Country, published in 1963, he introduces the motive of homelessness, but only in order to reaffirm the possibility of finding a new home after a long journey of strife and uncertainty. Quote, O girl without a road, O wayfarer without home, clouded with the pain are our pale afternoons. What will you relate about us after long wandering, when you'll enter, slender as ever, your radiant home? Lubchak's radiant home acquires a symbolic dimension and clearly points to the little world created especially for the space of writing. Lubchak does not dwell on alienation as much as Tarnovsky does. However, he stigmatizes the state of otherness. His lyrical hero is often a stranger, feeling awkward and misunderstood. But the sense of despair is absent, and the balance and deliverance come from creativity. The poem Poetry for a Poet sums up this beautifully, quote, your soul is a sheet of paper, carefully folded in between the pages of your never-read body. At night, spreading the soul on the table in front of yourself, you sketch thoughtful plans, and the hard pencil, not the gentle ink, hurtfully impresses your drawings. Creativity at home concerns Zhenia Vasilkivska as well. Her poetic output is slight because she left the new group in literature relatively early in the first half of the 1960s. The act of writing preoccupied her as much as it was in Lubchak's case. She has a number of verses addressing specifically poetry and poets. Her bard, Muse, is a highly intuitive being who through words feels the presence of God. In fact, in one of her poems, she makes it explicit. Addressing the poet Vasilkivska says, your words are an inmost pathway which God follows at times. Hers is a work in which poetry and nature conflate seamlessly. She personifies nature and personifies poetry, turning to the latter as if to a living entity. And now addressing poetry, she says, you are like a wreath of seed. A hammer of light crushing the shell will long glimmer after the traces of words, and the flood will not tear the nets and parcel out the sight that gathers generous harvest at dusk. Between milk and mint, hedge and thoughts, your green veins sprout with hawthorn, black-eyed thornbush, with the fire of wild rose. Vasilkivska rarely refers to contemporary reality. The density of her imagery and the abstract quality of her verse betray the exilic sensibility, mainly because they seem to act as protective shells against the encroaching realities of living outside the ordinary order of things. Poetry and nature become substitutive and compensating mechanisms. They also seem to alleviate the sense of loss brought on by displacement. The motive of homeless necessarily surfaces in this context, but her poem Batkivshchina, Fatherland, is so detached from historical reality that except for the title, one has hardly a clue to decipher its thematic strata. A subtle aura of nostalgia permeates the poem, all dressed up in imagery drawn from the world of nature. There is a reference to the broken bridges, rough roads, the horizon of bones, all presumably pointing to the horrors of war. But overall, the poem addresses the homeland as if it were an entity totally removed from the confines of time and space. What we have here is a construct of an imaginary home defined solely by the poet's imagination. The erotic in the poetry of Utrecht and Vasilkivska is implicit. It comes with a strong motivating undercurrent. Utrecht's rumination on love are marked by pessimism and betray existential underpinning. Loneliness and alienation are so rooted in human existence that even a union between a man and a woman, no matter how passionate, cannot alleviate them. In the end, any physical relationship reveals transient and inherent frailty. So the poet turns his attention towards those things that have more sustainable power. Poetry takes a prominent place in this equation and becomes his object of desire. Eros, in other words, is touched and moved first and foremost by the creative impulse. Desire for him unfolds itself in the poetic world and conjures up his lover, his muse. But Vasilkivska's poetry, on the other hand, is all about repressed desires, which resurface in the images intimating the forbidden subtext. As I have already alluded, nature plays a significant role in her oeuvre. It is often personified and eroticized. She talks, for example, about salty breaths of sea, desirous flowers, barren stones, sun that sighs lustfully. Moreover, hers is the poetry rich in images suggesting the attributes of the male reproductive organ, the images of tree trunks, poles, ribs, crescent moons, heart stones, thoughts, piercing rays simply abound in her verse. And that is nature where the human eroticism is uniquely Vasilkivska's in the context of a new group. In my attempt to elucidate the dynamic between Eros and Exile, I have focused thus far on the new group's six family members and paired them on the basis of three topoi, namely space, territory, language, and the muse. In the case of Butchuk and Tarnowski, there is a discernible inclination on their part to neutralize the exilic position by turning foreign territories into lovers rather than their homelands, and by questioning the efficacy of the concept of stable home. Kelena and Andrievska, on the other hand, direct all their creative energy towards language, transforming it into a battlefield of poetic ideas. Kelena's linguistic choice underscores her desire to enter a voluntary exile of sorts. Andrievska's idiosyncratic poetic vision is best expressed through the language. We'll have a drink.
Thank you.
Andrievska's idiosyncratic poetic vision is best expressed through the language, hermeticism of which, arguably, engenders at least an illusion of a voluntary exile into the world of words. And finally, in the case of Utrecht and Vasilkivska, we see an intricate interrelation between poetry as home and poetry as the muse that is a lover. None of these three paradigms fits the oath of Yerovok, the seventh and last member of the new group I want to focus on. The prevailing wisdom about exile is that, especially for an artist, it is a traumatic experience. It is not just because of pain caused by the physical separation, but also because so much of his or her creative vision is related to the cultural and linguistic realities of his or her country of origin. Yerovok's poetry displays her love for the lost homeland in a particularly pronounced way. Especially her early poems, included in the first two collections, Unique Youth, published in 1954, and Zoryakovna, Guiding Light, published in 1955, evince feelings of nostalgia and abound in images drawing on childhood memories. In some sense, hers is the oof reflecting the typical mode of exilic writing. That which is lost is desired and creatively reimagined. There's no confusion what her heart longs for. It is her native land, of course. And yet she manages, it seems, to strike a perfect balance between her affections for her country of origin and her adopted homeland, Brazil. Vogue has a number of poems which thematize the exotic beauty of Brazil and other countries of Latin America. Describing the atmosphere and local color, she always tries to find a trace that would reconnect her with the land she left behind. The poem Nad Morem, El Seaside, underscores this quite vividly. When the evening triggers an avalanche of stars down onto the ocean's shore, my soul sinks out of longing and tedium for my native sea, where the foam is whiter. The lyrical heroine longs not for him now, but for her then, which in her imagination looks more alluring. The absence of her native landscape only reinforces her nostalgic sentiment. Surprisingly, Vogue's mature poetry, that is the poetry published in the last decade, also conveys the beauty of Ukrainian land. She writes about her native Carpathian mountains, the wooden churches, and folk traditions. The land is emotional yet serene. Her love for the homeland is of agape rather than eros kind. She loves her country regardless of its condition or circumstances. In fact, she was the only member of a neo group to visit communist Ukraine in the late 60s as a tourist, even though some of her colleagues criticized that move and considered it as lacking an ideological stand on her part. However, Vogue's poetic oeuvre also thematizes love between a man and a woman. Eros emerges in her love poetry as a transgressive force. Vogue's collection Lyubovnye listy knyazhni Veroniki do Kardinala Giovanni Battisti, Love Letters of Princess Veronica to Cardinal Giovanni Battista, published in 1967, conveys the story of an unconsummated love affair between Princess Veronica, a woman of superb intelligence, proud and worldly, and Cardinal Giovanni Battista, a man of questionable integrity, fickle and untrustworthy. The poet avoids the transgressive forms of language. Instead, she explores and focuses on the nature of a transgressive relationship. After all, a sexual love between a layperson and a Catholic Church official is forbidden. This element of prohibition, however, is essential to the poem's gradual buildup of erotic tension. The lyrical heroine goes through a series of love stages, from the first half-conscious romantic longing to the hopes of deliverance to the realization of new prospects for a reciprocal union. What is particularly interesting about this poem is that it makes a compelling case for femininity without the appearance of giving in to masculine dominance. The most fascinating phase of Princess Veronica's love affair is the last phase, the phase of healing. The lyrical heroine is not apologetic, regains her pride, and calmly contemplates unfulfilled pleasure and desires. Quote, "My friend, you will never know the freshness of this body and the kisses, wild violets, that I reserved for you." The story ends with Princess voluntary exile to South America. For a proud heroine, this is the only logical outcome. After all, love and exile entail displacement and disorder of sorts. If anything, lovers and exiles have this in common. Both treasure their perceived lack. Both dwell in the other space, and both allow to be governed by time. Anne Clausen makes an interesting comment, quote, "The experience of Eros is a study in the ambiguities of time. Lovers are always waiting," end of quote. And I would add that exiles are waiting too. The poets of the neo group, even though they reluctantly or hardly ever touched the subject of exile, nevertheless they were all deeply entangled in the workings of time. Their poetic fascination with death is also a function of time. Death is central because it implies an ultimate loss. And exile has to reconcile with the thought of never seeing his native country again. Thematizing difference, linguistic and territorial, as well as estrangement and separation through the passage of time, lies at the heart of the group's poetic output and clearly elucidates its exilic sensibility. What I'm trying to convey here is that even if one is somewhat in denial of his or her exilic condition, it will invariably strike back from behind by exposing all the inconsistencies in the process of reconfiguring the topoi of identification. For Yuri Tarnovsky, it is a split in loyalties between enticing Spain and suffering Ukraine. Boczuk falls in love with Mexico but cannot forget the images of his dying mother, who can be easily conflated with his lost homeland. Vera Vogue hesitates between the beauty of all to Rio Brazil, and who left behind reimagined native land. Quilima and Andiesca transcended territorial space altogether in order to dwell in the space of language. Quilima's literary bilingualism contrasts with Andiesca's monolingual approach. However, both poets excelled in building their own separate poetic universes. Rubchak and Vasilkivska, on the other hand, turned to Ars Poetica, the muse, in order to overcome the linguistic and cultural periphery. Poetry is a portable home for them. They carry it like snails carry their own protective shells. If exilic reality spurs to renegotiate the concept of home, Eros helps to move it through space and time. And Carlson puts it as follows, quote, "The blind point of Eros is a paradox in time as well as in space, a desire to bring the absent into presence or to collapse far and near. It's also a desire to so close as then upon now. As lover, you reach forward to a point in time called then, when you bite into the long-desired apple. Meanwhile, you are aware that as soon as then supervenes upon now, the bittersweet moment, which is your desire, will be gone. You cannot want that, and yet you do." End of quote. In Phaedrus, one of Plato's dialogues on love, Socrates admits the importance of time in any evaluation of the erotic experience. A lover should ask himself what it is he wants from time, because in the madness of desire, he would want his beloved to remain unchanged, to remain in the now forever. Yet in his discourse, Socrates goes well beyond the mortal confines of mere carnal pleasure. Platonic Eros is also known through the metaphor of wings. Socrates even resorts to a little verse to underscore this image, quote, "Mortals call him Eros, love, but the immortals call him Pteros, fluttering doves, because the fluttering of wings is as a necessity to him." End of quote. Hence, Plato's Eros implies an upward movement. He is man's way to the divine and the immortal. Love, in other words, is always a desire for the higher and more perfect. It is acquisitive because it aims at possessing an object perceived as valuable and egocentric because it centers on the individual self and its destiny. But in the structure of Platonic Eros, there's also a hint of flight from the sense world into the ideal world. And from this angle, Eros itself acquires exilic attributes. He reifies exile and at the same time helps to alleviate its disorder. To a varying extent and with a varying success, Eros inspired all the poets of the Neon Group. Following the devastation of World War II, which they witnessed either as youth or children, the poets turned to functional, at the time existentialism, for answers. The erotic imagery became for them a vehicle for conveying existentialist views, especially the need for freedom and responsibility for each individual choice. The centrality of individualism in their poetry has some affinity with the Platonic egocentric Eros. Moreover, the erotic metaphor was employed by them to probe the boundaries of the transgressive and the other, be it an adopted homeland or a lover. As I have already pointed out, Eros is not only explicitly thematized in the group's poetic text, but also emerges as a kind of behind-the-scenes compulsion inferred from the tension between images symbolically revisional and their contextual exilic position. If Plato's Eros is striving for the immortal and the divine, then the new group's Eros is longing for a new world, a new logos, a new poetic territory. In other words, the divine is replaced by poetry. For the members of the newer group, poetry has the power to overcome the exotic margin and, in fact, constitutes for them a peculiar love affair lived out in time and space. As with any love affair, a lover is full of hopeful anticipation. He or she yearns for the acknowledgement of all the wonderful attributes that he, her beloved, is equipped with, and believe that the beauty and goodness emanating from him, her, have a universal appeal. These were also the hopes of the poets of the New York group with regard to their poetic output. Having worked within the confines of the emigre audience for more than 30 years, they nonetheless expected that sooner or later their oeuvre would find a way to a wider readership. The exilic condition for the New York group began to dissipate in the late 1980s and became reality after Ukraine gained independence in 1991. Since then, the members of the group have made numerous trips back to their native land, and some, like Bogdan Bochuk, even decided to settle there permanently. Their literary and publishing activity was necessarily transferred to Kyiv, simply because the emigre readership shrank significantly. During the 1990s, the group managed to briefly influence the literary process by publishing, for example, the journal Seat of It. All this would indicate a considerable degree of acceptance and recognition by the center. In practical terms, however, the New York group has never been truly incorporated into the contemporary literary scene. Despite publishing their works there in the past decade, the New York poets are by and large perceived as outsiders in Ukraine. Their poetic innovations are acknowledged, but at the same time historicized. Their version of modernism is studied, but again, in historical rather than contemporaneous terms. And it appears at least to some members of the group, still beaming with youthful energy and eager to argue, this attitude is somewhat wanting. Yet their desire to have a meaningful dialogue with the younger generations of Ukrainian literati has been left unfulfilled. It is tempting to compare the New York group's interaction with the literary center to that of a disappointed lover. After Ukraine gained independence, the poets' liaison with their native land has brought to surface many ambivalent feelings. They yearn for a wholesale embrace there, but encounter for the most part a silent gaze. This, of course, has no bearing on their poetic logos. In the end, the members of the New York group realize that their true embrace or satisfaction could only come from a word left on a page. Thus, creativity itself became a center and a point of destination. The lover's only care is to be with his beloved. With their poetic art by their side, the poets of the New York group feel at home no matter where their physical presence takes them. As Plato's lovers, they, quote, live in light always, happy companions in their pilgrimage, and when the time comes at which they receive their wings, they have the same plumage because of their love. Thank you.